A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations and institutions. Today, we'll look at how the current discussions of sexual misconduct are being reflected in the classical music world. Allegations this past week rocked major institutions, including the Metropolitan Opera and the New York City Ballet, and observers and critics are pondering what's next. I'll speak with arts consultant Drew McManus about how performing arts organizations should be responding and working to make their environments safer for all their artists. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. There were some mixed reports from orchestras this week as they reviewed their financial performance of the past year. The Cleveland Orchestra reported that it faced a growing deficit amid declines in donations and large gifts. According to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the orchestra's deficit increased 75% to $4.2 million. On the positive side of the ledger, the orchestra reported that concert attendance at its main concert venue, Severance Hall, was the same as the previous year, an all-time high, according to the newspaper, and its endowment rose by almost $20 million to a high of $192 million. In addition, the orchestra seems to be attracting more younger music lovers, with college students accounting for about 20% of its audience. The Indianapolis Symphony also reported results for the 2016-2017 season. According to the Indianapolis Business Journal, the orchestra saw a budget surplus of $27,000, helped by a fifth straight year of record ticket sales and reduced medical claims. Ticket sales may also have been bolstered by younger audiences. The orchestra sold nearly 10,000 student tickets, which the Indianapolis Business Journal said was a record. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. Before Time magazine highlighted the topic of sexual assault by naming the women who came forward to tell their stories of abuse as its Collective Person of the Year, The waves of the Me Too movement that most recently had its start with the downfall of Hollywood power player Harvey Weinstein began to ripple into the classic music world this week. First, the Metropolitan Opera suspended longtime music director James Levine after allegations of sexual misconduct were published, first by the New York Post and then by the New York Times. Shortly thereafter, the New York Times reported that the New York City Ballet and School of American Ballet were investigating charges of sexual assault against their longtime head, Peter Martins. Both the Met and the Ballet have hired outside firms to investigate the claims. Levine now faces allegations by four individuals, including a violinist who later went on to play in the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra. According to the New York Times, Levine denied the allegations in a written statement, and on Friday, Illinois officials announced that no charges would be filed against him in connection with one of the incidents, because at the time of the alleged assault in 1986, the age of consent in the state was 16, the age that the accuser was at the time. In response, others in the classical music world, from critics and journalists to musicians, began to weigh in on the extent to which sexual abuse and harassment may have been ignored and kept quiet over the years, what impact that will have now, and what these types of allegations could and should mean for an artist's legacy. In one example, Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic at the New York Times, wrote in his article this week about his painful decision to move his box set of Levine's Met recordings to a less prominent space in his home collection. This issue is by no means limited to the U.S. This past week, the Incorporated Society of Musicians, the UK's professional organization for musicians, released a report called Dignity at Work, based on responses to a survey conducted during the month of November. It found that more than half of the respondents said that they had experienced some form of discrimination in their work experience, of which nearly two-thirds reported being subject to some form of sexual harassment or inappropriate behavior, including groping, inappropriate comments, or the proverbial casting couch. Of those, 77% said they did not report the incident, often out of fear of losing work or of not being believed or taken seriously. The questions of what role arts institutions have played and should play going forward in preventing, investigating, and reacting to allegations of sexual assault are bound to be discussed in boardrooms and staff meetings in the coming weeks, as well as among musicians and audiences. To get a sense of some of these issues that will be under the microscope and how arts organizations might make some headway in addressing the situation, I call Drew McManus, an arts consultant in Chicago and author of the blog Adaptistration.
One of the underlying problems of the large ensemble classical music field, so orchestras and operas, is it's grown organically in a nonprofit environment that doesn't have the same sort of outward pressures that have helped develop human resource departments in their corporate counterparts. Because of that, you'll find even mid-sized organizations that have absolutely no full-time HR employees. It's not until you start to reach the larger institutions that you even get an HR manager. And even then, compared to their for-profit counterparts, it usually pales in comparison. One of the byproducts of this, I think, is that you're starting to see a culture that doesn't have the infrastructure that helps prevent these sorts of abuses from happening.
A lot of people now are scratching their heads and saying, in some instances, for example, the Met, people are saying now, well, yeah, I had heard all the rumors, or we knew the rumors were out there, but how do we wind up with a culture where things happen and yet people hear things and nothing gets followed up on, even from when people are supposedly seem to be talking to each other?
And that's another direct question to this lack of HR problem. I'm trying to think of a good way to maybe look at it from multiple perspectives, because I think this is where you get what I like to think of as a conflux of information. So rumors. You have a number of rumors that are coming in from different sources, from people who are usually mutually exclusive, not connected in any way. But as the institution, to put the resources into following through on those and to create an environment that makes it easier and protects people who need to come forward and make allegations. Because ultimately, without the allegation, there's not much an employer can do unless they just happen to stumble across something. But it's that lack of safe environment to help individuals who need to make an allegation or someone who knows of a problem who can bring it to the attention of the organization. Unless that's a welcome enough of an environment, then you end up with a sort of cover-up, head-in-the-sand outcome that we have right now. I think Title IX in the academic world is a good model for the nonprofit performing arts industry to look at if they really want to pull themselves out of this hole, where that structure has developed over a number of years, and in the last 10 especially, has really kicked into hyperdrive, where there's a much tighter degree of regulation and much clearer instructions on what institutions need to do to create those environments that help prevent sexual misconduct.
Well, there've been there's one way in which what we're hearing now in the classical music world does seem to reflect very much the Hollywood model, in terms of the music world has so many free agents, so to speak, so many individual musicians, or even as students are moving up through their careers. How does that contribute to this, to these challenges when you have people who are trying to make their careers on the one hand, and on the other hand, huge names that can really make and break their careers?
Right, and this is one element that I think is hidden to most people. When you go to a concert, you don't realize that behind the scenes in the classical music business, there is this for-profit element. It's strictly commercial. That's going to be artist representation, artist managers. They're the people who represent the individual guest artists, singers, conductors, soloists, so on and so forth. They represent them to the institution. They represent them to the public. That is a very money-driven process. And just like anything that comes down to money, there's going to be a tremendous amount of effort directed toward protecting those money makers. So if you have someone who reaches a star level like the Met situation, and that individual's revenue-generating capacity is threatened, you'll get people who will go into aggressive defense, let's call it, and they'll use whatever pressure they can to protect that revenue asset, in this case, the artist. That is not a terribly beneficial variable for creating an environment to help prevent sexual misconduct. And you're right, with inside the classical music field as compared to Hollywood, there is such a high competition-driven environment among individual musicians who are going to be the full-time employees, that they're going to be in an even more vulnerable position to be potential victims of that sexual misconduct.
Well, in the long term, how damaging is this to the Met? We've seen a number of comments about, can the Met survive this? What's your take on that?
It does have the potential for becoming an organization killer. You know, I don't think that necessarily means that the organization will shut down, but the Met as an institution of being as at the forefront of being the leader in its field is threatened. And once you move back past that position, then it will take decades for it to regain that public trust and to regain its same artistic standing.
Well, at the same time, we're also hearing from music lovers that to what extent does this tarnish the legacy? For example, in the case of James Levine, there was one article, Anthony Tomasini came out and said, do I keep my collection of his recordings? Based on things in the past and going forward, how much of an ethical, moral dilemma does this pose for a musician and an artist's legacy?
Well, for the individual musician, I think it should be attached to their legacy. There are plenty of examples of musicians and artists over centuries that as time has gone forward, information has come out, and it's no secret that they were not wonderful people, and they had issues and problems. I think what's fair for the listener is, because art does ultimately transcend politics, it transcends religion, it transcends culture, is the artist, the individual artist, needs to have whatever problems that they were the cause of in their life be associated with their reputation. Having said that, the art that they create with other individuals is going to help create something that transcends that. I don't think it should ever excuse or whitewash what had happened. You know, if these allegations come out and they are proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that they are true, then Levine's reputation is always going to be one of having committed those crimes. At the same time, it doesn't change the performance that was made at that point in time. So I do think there is a way to be able to separate those two elements from one another. No, I don't think we should all go out and throw out our Levine recordings. But at the same time, everyone should realize what he did if that turns out to be true when they're listening to it. In that sense, I almost can't think of a better way to help remind people why it's important not to contribute to an environment that makes it easier for people to do these sorts of things.
So now looking forward at the general music world, classical music world, this certainly is, as you said, does go beyond the Met. Do you see new dominoes falling in short order, or what's your short and long-term prognosis on where this topic goes in the next couple of months?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised in the least if there are going to be more stories that come out over time. One of the things that, you know, that's always interesting to do if you're an insider in this field is to sit around and go out for a drink with colleagues and talk shop. And these sorts of things come up with individuals that you're comfortable enough to talk to them from time to time. And I just know from my own years in the field, as well as so many of my colleagues, that there are other people who have sexual misconduct or other similar sorts of abuses that are attached to their reputation in a rumor state. And there's enough of those rumors and that conflux of information that you do have to really wonder what's going on. Go into any major ensemble and just start asking the musicians for their own Me Too style stories, and you'll likely find plenty. It is to some degree, I think, potentially worse than the corporate field, and probably more like Hollywood, in that when you have something that is going to be so artistically driven, it almost seems like sexual misconduct and the arts have a higher degree of interaction than other fields. I would be surprised and shocked, quite frankly, if there were other stories that don't come out in the next year or two.
There certainly are different layers in terms of responsibility and how that plays out. We saw that, you know, certainly with when the Catholic Church was going through issues and different specific institutions. And that raises the question of the institutional versus individual perpetrator responsibility. What comes to mind is you're familiar perhaps with the American Boy Choir School, which for various reasons had to close down in the past year, mostly financial, but one of the issues that seemed to contribute to the financial and other structural issues was back in the 80s and 90s, and then coming out, I guess, in the early 2000s, allegations of sexual abuse. And it seemed that as much as the school tried to get away from that, they kept coming up. So the question always was, well, how much did that contribute to financial concerns? At what point do accusations, allegations, and the institutions hopefully responsible response to that. Do you reach a point at which there's a separation once an institution has made enough steps that its legacy can continue without those allegations dodging it?
You know, the Catholic Church comparison is a terrific parallel, because I think that's something that has really plagued an institution, the Catholic Church, that they've never really been able to dig out from under and even from, oh gosh, what was that wonderful movie about the Boston, the investigative journalism that uncovered the efforts to keep the issues under wraps and quiet. And that was as damaging, if not more, than the actual sexual misconduct. And this is where the Met and all performing arts organizations are at a real crossroads. And the Met will be the first institution to really demonstrate either some difficult leadership, but necessary leadership, or they're going to retreat to self-protection mode. And the self-protection mode is ultimately going to be self-defeating. It's not like religion where there's a large enough base where they can pull on those resources to sustain that kind of damage. The nonprofit classical music field is far more fragile, and this is where things can fall apart very quickly if they don't embrace not just a degree of culpability, but also institute some profound change. Now, having said that, the very good news in all of that is doing something like absorbing the amount of culpability that's necessary and putting that change into motion are comparatively easy things to do.
What would be some steps that you think organizations should be taking now as they start moving ahead?
Well, I'll use maybe the Met as the example because they're probably the most tangible at this point. With the Levine allegations, they've come out and said they want to investigate the allegations, but they haven't said anything about exploring their own history on the executive administration level to what sorts of measures they instituted over the years to try to investigate a conflux of rumor or create that environment that allowed potential victims to come forward and make the allegations they need to. It's one thing to say we haven't heard of anything. It's another thing to then determine that, well, it wasn't as though you made it easy for anyone who was a victim to come forward and make those allegations either. So, there's a real help hindrance element in this. The Met can ideally bring in an independent investigator that doesn't report necessarily to the executive administration to be able to study and really take a hard look into the organization's history, at least over the past decade, and then make the appropriate recommendations for what they need to do moving forward to create a better environment. And if they uncover any irregularities in the past, then to also make those publicly known to help build and maintain public trust.
Now, I know I've often checked in with you at the end of the year, the look at the year in review, with these allegations coming so close to the end of the year and people kind of looking back and deciding how to wrap up, the importance of, the significance of the past year. Where do you see this topic finding up or winding up in terms of looking back on the past year in classical music?
It's as big of an issue, it almost wouldn't matter when it happened. Even if it started January 1st, it should still be one of the largest, if not the largest issue for the field as a whole for 2017, because it is a real event that is a time of reckoning, and there are a lot of chickens that have come to roost that the field's going to have to address and do not just a better job, but also acknowledge the mistakes of the past. I would hope that moving forward, the issue of how much influence that the commercial sector of the field has is something that I think will begin to teach boards that it is ultimately their responsibility as the stewards of public trust that they can't allow those outside forces to place such pressure on the institution that they make it easy for them to decide not to put the sorts of HR measures in place that need to be. And it isn't just necessarily artist managers. You know, as a consultant myself, there's more than enough consultants that are also commercially driven who are going to have their own interests in mind that aren't necessarily aligning with institutional mission and their responsibility to protect the people that work for them and that they come into contact with, whether they be children, young artists, or artists at any stage in their career. So there almost aren't enough questions to ask about how each of those points of contact influence the decisions that board members make. I think if there's one thing that is a real problem right now, it is this lack of attention into institutional responsibility. And it's not as though it should be any kind of effort to go out and crucify any single individual, but these are difficult questions that are going to require thorough processes. And if anyone thinks that you can emerge from this kind of mess without getting dirty, then that in and of itself should be an alarm bell to stakeholders.
Actually, that raises one more question I hadn't thought about earlier, but you know, we're talking about institutions as, you know, as a whole. In this case, though, there were instances where it was one institution, the Met, and also I believe Ravinia. It's not necessarily that it was just one board that could have put a stop to it, but how does that interplay in that dynamic add to the complexity?
Well, actually, I think it helps more than hurts. Because these are all large budget institutions. They all do, compared to other groups, have far more resources to be able to put the sorts of measures in place to do not just their own thorough review of the past decade or more, but then put together measures of self-regulation that are closely aligned to something that we see with Title IX and academia. And if they fail to do this, then it does become an issue of perhaps the best way to move forward is with some sort of federal oversight and regulation on the government level. They are nonprofits. They do receive that status. It's not beyond the pale to consider that there should be potentially regulation to require institutions to begin to adopt similar measures that academic institutions have to.
That was my conversation with Drew McManus, an arts consultant and author of the blog Adaptistration. You can find his blog at adaptistration.com. I hope you enjoy these conversations about the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world that I bring you each week on Otempo. But remember, programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, now celebrating 35 years on the air, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.